poor considering the exit of Jeffrey Katzenberg, the failure to honor his contract, and the hiring and firing of Michael Ovitz. Personnel and judgment errors which, in the cost to Disney and the vitriol and publicity they generated, are without parallel in American business history. For all the lip service paid to shareholder value, Disney under Eisner was managed not for all of its shareholders, but primarily for three: Eisner himself, Sid Bass and his family interests, and, until their rupture, the Disney family represented by Roy and Stanley Gold. Nowhere was this more evident than in the makeup of the Disney board, which for most of Eisner's tenure was riddled with conflicts of interest. Board members were no doubt lulled into complacency by the extraordinary success of Eisner's early years. Still, Eisner controlled and manipulated the board by keeping members isolated, preferring to communicate one-on-one, selectively doling out information, access, and benefits, like tickets to the Super Bowl, and ruthlessly dispatching anyone who dared challenge him. The most striking example is Eisner's shameful treatment of Andrea Van de Kamp, a symbolic execution in which other board members sat passively by. Only an elementary school educator, Ravetta Bowers, had the courage to speak out, and she, too, was already on her way out. Eisner and other executives, especially Tom Staggs, deserve credit for not running seriously afoul of securities laws during a time of rampant corporate scandal. But Disney's decisions not to revalue the Family Channel and seek a substantial tax benefit, and not to take this issue to the board, raise serious questions. When did things start to go wrong? Almost everyone who has ever worked at Disney offers the same answer: the sudden and tragic death of Frank Wells in 1994, 10 years into Eisner's reign. They argue that Wells was Eisner's check and balance, his rudder, his sounding board. Wells, and Wells alone, could question Eisner, disagree with him, get him to change his mind. When anyone had a problem with Eisner from Katzenberg on down, they could go to Frank for redress. Wells was their ombudsman, their court of appeal. He made Disney executives feel valued and appreciated, leavening Eisner's sometimes harsh demands for ever harder work, followed by scant praise. There is no doubt a good deal of truth to these assessments, but they fail to explain the fact that Disney was already beginning to decline by the time of Wells's death. Wells hadn't succeeded in restraining Eisner in the building of Euro Disney. He had not been able to resolve the mounting crisis with Katzenberg. Wells's relationship with Eisner was fraying, suggested by Eisner's outbursts in front of Ovitz and his wife, and Wells's own laments to Stanley Gold. The answer seems more deeply rooted in Eisner's complex personality. Eisner is intelligent, charming, and funny. As his early years demonstrated, he has enormous creative skills and energy, and his management style in his early years at Disney, admittedly unorthodox and highly centralized, unleashed the same in others. Then, slowly but surely, as success mounted, Eisner's own identity fused with that of Disney itself. Many observers date this process to